Everyone's asleep. Everyone but me. And I can't help feel like I'm doing this all by myself.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of madness and chaos and Skype being a bunch of scumbags, if you lose your sense of humour, you'll go friggin' nuts. My very special guest is Daniel Johnson from Panda. No, he doesn't live in China and protect endangered species. Well, he lives in America and protects endangered species, namely free Americans who are from the NDAA. No, that's not a wrestling group. It stands for the National Defense Authorization Act. National meaning globalist, defense meaning attacking, and authorization meaning stealing, and act meaning they're making it up as they go along. Daniel, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Did I give a reasonable assessment of the situation just there?
Well, I couldn't say too much better myself. Now, I'm sure some lawyers would disagree with you, but hey, and any way you can explain it, that's the best. Especially if we can do it with humor.
Yeah, indeed, particularly right now. So, could you just explain to us a little bit about the nice, lovely Panda Association that you've got there? Or unless we'd prefer to reconnect you on the phone first.
Yeah, let's do the phone first.
Okay, because you seem to be coming across a Skype for me, not badly, but I'm not sure if it's working the other way around for you.
Yeah, I'm just having a hard time hearing you, that's all. If we can reconnect via landline, we're good.
Okay, not a problem. AFR, we've got his number in there. If you can please give Dan a ring, we should be able to reconnect. Okay, they're on it.
All right, this is AFR, right?
Yeah.
All right, hang on.
All right. So, do we have Dan on the line there?
I'm here.
Sweet! Okay.
Sweet! Coming right through, loud and clear.
Let's go straight on into it then. Tell us a little bit about yourself and what Panda is all about.
All right, well, Panda, we're almost a year old now. Our birthday will actually be a week from today. And we were started on January 29th of last year to block the NDAA, or the indefinite detention of anyone around the world, including American citizens, without charge and without trial. And I'm a Bowling Green State University sophomore and about 19 years old, Eagle Scout, and This is just really something that when I saw a video on the NDAA, when I saw exactly how bad it was, I couldn't sit and do nothing. And so Panda started late January, and since then we have rocketed out to a huge network. In fact, we've had articles carried in Huffington Post, Western Journalism, Policy Mike. We've been on almost 75 or so radio shows, and we have about half of the country with state teams working right now, and 14 states with legislation against the NDAA to stop indefinite detention right here in America, and to hopefully eventually block it at the federal level to keep citizens from around the world who aren't American from being indefinitely detained in American prisons.
Okay. So essentially, any American could go to Guantanamo for any reason, any crazed authority figure with a uniform says.
Well, the actual language says belligerent act. So, you know, you're shaking your fist at the local government building, and the next thing you know, you're black bagged in a white van and on your way to Guantanamo.
Yeah. It seems that V for Vendetta is a really prophetic film for a lot of us. And I think it's incidentally, you know, the reason why everybody wears these Guy Fawkes masks all over the place. Problem being, you don't know exactly how to stop a regime like that, but the answer is ultimately just any way you can. So specifically, what is the purpose of Panda? Could you explain the NDAA in even more detail? So just so that we get a feel of exactly what we're dealing with here.
Yeah, precisely. The NDAA, or National Defense Authorization Act, is usually just a bill that authorizes spending for the U.S. military. It keeps U.S. troops fed. It keeps U.S. troops paid when they go home, paid on leave, to make sure they have the tools they need. And it passes every year. In fact, it just passed for the 51st time this past year. Well, since it passes every year, it became that proverbial haystack where someone would throw their needles into. And so after 9/11 was a prime example of the U.S. just throwing away its constitution and trampling on civil liberties. So in 2007, the John Warner National Defense Authorization Act was passed. Now, this authorized a military unit to operate on U.S. soil, which is forbidden by Posse Comitatus, and only on U.S. soil, for civil disobedience and crowd control purposes. This was later repealed, and the unit was basically gotten rid of in 2009. However, it laid the path for the 2012 NDAA. In a nutshell, 2012 NDAA violates 14 provisions of the U.S. Constitution and authorizes the indefinite detention of anyone around the world. If you're not a U.S. citizen, the military is required to detain you. If you are a U.S. citizen, the U.S. military has the option. Indefinite detention, without a charge, without a trial, without access to an attorney, without the chance to see your family again, and applies the laws of war and military force to U.S. soil for the first time since the Civil War. And even in the Civil War, this was unconstitutional. This is wrong in the U.S. This is humanely wrong in the U.S. So in applying the laws of war, the U.S. military can now execute. Under our current law, the United States military can go anywhere in the world. That's New Zealand, that's Sweden, that's U.S., that's Canada. Execute someone. Pay no price for it. Even if they're an American, Australian, New Zealand, coalition partner citizen, it doesn't matter. Execution is now pretty much legal for the United States government to carry out.
Okay. So, can I ask you just how many parts of the general freedoms that Americans enjoy. I mean, what are there parts of the Constitution that this specifically violates, for example?
Absolutely. The 1st, 2nd, 4th, 5th, 6th, 8th, 10th, and 14th Amendments of the U.S. Constitution are violated.
Let me rephrase.
Go ahead.
What, let me rephrase. What part of the Constitution does this not violate?
The 3rd Amendment, because it's not asking us to quarter troops in our houses yet. And then the procedural stuff within the, like, you know, a house, a bill has to go to the House to get the appropriations and then has to go, yeah. So besides procedural things and procedural errors, just about every basic right is violated by the NDAA. And then you can't even go that far, because as soon as you institute a second track like Nazi Germany did, they had a two-track system. They had the military, and they had the civilian track and the criminal track. Well, now we've added the military track for anyone around the world. And this military track, if they put you on that track, you don't get any of your constitutional rights, no matter what part of the Constitution you try to pull from. So, in essence, there isn't a part of the Constitution that doesn't violate, because it throws the whole thing out.
Great. So, in a nutshell, if you were to define it really quickly, would you say the NDAA turns the United States from a republic into a dictatorship?
A republic into a military battlefield.
So it's a declaration of war on the American people, isn't it?
Absolutely.
How exactly are the American people supposed to fight a war against their own government?
Well, those who make peaceful revolution impossible make violent revolution inevitable. The last thing we want in America is a violent revolution. Communism comes about and springs up and inserts its deadly roots through violent revolution. The last thing we want in America is violent revolution. So we have to do our dangdest to make peaceful revolution possible. And what we have to, as Americans, we have to realize that, number one, this is a war on us. This is a war on our rights. So we need to stop treating this like a criminal action. One bill comes out, everybody goes out in the street, they protest, they go home, they sit back on their couch, they eat their popcorn, they talk to people on Facebook about how bad the world is. Well, guess what? That's if it was a criminal action, if it was one bill violating the Constitution, that's understandable. It is a war for our rights. And since it is a war for our rights, the American people have to be consistent. The American people have to start at the local level. If you imagine the United States government as a pyramid, and you have at the top, you have whoever you want to put there. You can put CFR, you can put the bankers, you can put whoever you want up there. And then under them, you have the President of the United States and the executive branch, Congress, and all the other federal branches. Under them, you have the state governments. And then under them, you have county and local governments. And then you have law enforcement, industry-level bureaucrats under them. If you knock off the top of the pyramid, let's say you get rid of the Federal Reserve. If you knock off the top of the pyramid, all someone has to do is walk up that pyramid and place a new top on it. It's not that hard, because they're walking up the pyramid of corruption. If, however, you start taking brick by brick by brick out of the bottom of that pyramid until it reaches 51% of the bricks, or the local and city governments, the city and county governments, the state governments even, that say, I will not comply, I do not consent to what the federal government is doing, you get 51%, the pyramid topples. And no one can put another head on that pyramid. No one can really build another pyramid with any sort of speed. And that's what needs to happen in America, is starting at the local level. We will not comply with unconstitutional laws. Unconstitutional laws are null and void from the get-go, and we will not comply, because America is the last bastion of liberty, or it's been seen as the last bastion of liberty around the world. America is one of the only countries, if not the only country, founded on the idea that all men were created equal and were endowed with inalienable rights that cannot be taken by any man or any government. And with that, we have the best chance here in America to stop this tyranny from spreading to New Zealand, to stop this tyranny from establishing a world government, if you will. And you see it in every comic book. You see it, though it's always the bad guy wants the world. Well, guess what? It's rooted in truth. It's rooted in something real. And the reality is America is the last place they have to take out. It's the city on the hill, if you will. And once America has been taken out and once the United States troops and their 1,000-ish or 180-ish military bases around the world, once those troops are used for tyranny, it will not just be American tyranny, it will be world tyranny. And that's why the American people have to, little by little, piece by piece, start taking action and start saying, we will not comply with unconstitutional laws. We have every right under the Constitution not to comply with those laws. That's how we'll take our country back.
Mm. Well, you know what would be really, really scary for anybody else in the rest of the world is a world dominated by Americans living under a tyranny, namely because Americans know very, very little about the rest of the world in general. Probably be the worst system you could ever possibly imagine. And essentially just being used as pawns in a game. What percentage of United Nations peacekeeping troops are actually American troops, exactly?
I have no idea.
It's something like 50%, right? Like half the world's army or peacekeepers or whatever are Americans, simply subcontracted to the UN. Walking around wearing blue helmets like a giant bullet, like giant bullet magnets on their heads. You know what I'm saying?
like a bullet magnet. Like, I mean, the UN could have been. They could have called themselves the Redcoats, walked around in in full headgear, and maybe even thrown a couple feathers on top.
Well, maybe they just want to bruise you blue. So. We'll talk about this after the break, actually. Dan Johnson from Panda is my guest, and that is pandaunite.org. That's pandaunite.org. We'll be right back, folks. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, broadcasting live from the island chained nation of New Zealand, where it's so hot you can't do your show with pants on. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and, incidentally, the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. At this particular moment in time, ladies and gentlemen, we are desperately, underline desperately, point some fingers at it with a big exclamation point, desperately in need of your support. Please, if you've ever listened to this show and I have made you cackle, or I have brought on a guest that you've suggested, or I have taught you something that is enlightening or useful or something that is actually relevant to your life, please give me something for that, just so I can continue to do it. I don't care whether it's $5 or $500 or $500,000. Please give something so that I don't have to live hand to mouth and just be so totally stressed all the time. I really try very hard to make sure that people who basically deserve the media coverage. You know, people like my guest Dan Johnson from Panda talking about the NDAA. He's a person who deserves media coverage because he's talking about something that really affects every American, and conversely, once it's implemented, will affect everybody in the world. The media does not cover these things anymore. Only people like me do. And the only way people like me that can survive and continue to do it is because of you and your generous support listening to these networks like American Freedom Radio. Go to the VinnieEastwoodShow.com and donate today. Please. Go there and subscribe for a couple of dollars a month or anything like that so we have some regular income. I only want to do more. I only want to give coverage to those who deserve it. But I can't do it without you. Please help me do what needs to be done. Thank you. My very special guest, Dan Johnson from PandaUnite.org. Welcome back.
Now, well, thank you.
Ammunition, bro. This is the top story on your thing. Homeland Security's ammo appetite is hurting local law enforcement. Can you define that one for me?
Well, yeah, this is a very, very important issue to look at. Obviously, after the terrible tragedy at Sandy Hook Elementary in Connecticut, the American people started buying up ammo and guns and assault weapons, quote-unquote assault weapons, left and right, all over the place. We've heard stories here all the way from 6 months to get a weapon here in America. This is what the back order is looking like. And even before Americans went on this ammo and gun buying craze, the Department of Homeland Security purchased $750 million rounds of hollow point ammunition. To put that in perspective, that is 10 times more than we expend in 1 year in Iraq for our military.
You know, ironically, I don't think you can put that kind of weapon, that kind of ammunition into perspective. I mean, and also hollow point ammunition, those are they're not supposed to travel through bodies or anything like that. They're not designed to wound, are they?
No, they're designed to kill, and if you use one of them on a target, you're going to waste that target. So they're not for target practice. At the very least, at the very hopeful explanation for this, there was some serious incompetence in the Department of Homeland Security saying that you should order hollow point ammunition, which is much more expensive than regular ammunition, and use it for target practice. And at the unfortunately likely, but other side of the spectrum is the fact that the Department of Homeland Security could be stockpiling for something, and stockpiling maybe for a war against the American people. And why else would you need? I mean, you have to wonder. It's the things that draw questions. And why else would you need 750 million rounds of ammunition? And this is causing police departments to not have the ammunition they need to train. And then what happens is the Homeland Security says, okay, we'll give you a grant. And then those police departments go under Homeland Security's wing. And eventually you have a situation like you had in Nazi Germany, where the Department of Homeland Security in Nazi Germany was the police. Everyone was Department of Homeland Security. The President of the United States put out an executive order recently that formed an advisory council. Sounds harmless. Sounds like just a bunch of people getting together to talk. Guess who's heading the council? Department of Homeland Security. This brings every government branch at least under the watchful eye, not yet under the wing of the Department of Homeland Security, who has purchased 750 million rounds of ammunition. And you have to wonder, that's three bullets for every man, woman, and child in the entire United States, and then some.
What are the implications of that? I mean, how How are local law enforcement actually responding to this situation? Is there any local sheriffs or anything that have come out publicly to talk about this? What?
Oh, of course not. Most local law enforcement has already been integrated into the federal network. They've done a great job. Department of Homeland Security and the federal government has done a stellar job since 9/11, basically federalizing all the police forces in the nation. Because federal money comes with strings. So when they give police departments some funds to buy some new SWAT gear, when they give police departments some funds to buy a drone, when they give a sheriff's department some funds to buy a Bearcat or an armored vehicle, comes with strings. And so, no, they're not going to speak up about it. They're not. Very few people are willing to bite the hand that feeds them anyway, especially if that hand is the Department of Homeland Security. So, no, they're not going to speak up about it. If they say anything, they'll just say, well, you know, we're kind of running out of ammo. It's a combination of things. It's Homeland Security. It's the new town. People buying up ammo there. And we're just going to hold back for a little bit.
Okay. Well, can I ask you as well, just in terms of the local law enforcement, what about sheriffs? Aren't sheriffs supposed to be elected by local people in order to serve their local communities? And exactly how has this process subverted that?
Yes, sheriffs are supposed to be elected, and most sheriffs, not all, in fact, Missouri, Missouri or just St. Louis, Missouri, but Missouri got appointed sheriffs instead of elected sheriffs, and that is something that is moving across the country is what they're attempting to do with it. And there are groups such as the Constitutional Sheriffs and Peace Officers Association, who are constitutional sheriffs and sheriffs who understand the Constitution and their duty as a sheriff to interpose. However, this process of giving grants, there was an article in Lou Rockwell recently, is talking about you take the nickel, you better be ready to work for it. So when the federal government hands out a grant, says, hey, there's $500,000, we're going to see who wants it. As soon as that person gets that $500,000, well, guess what, they're under the federal government's thumb. In fact, there was a few people in... I want to say it was either San Francisco or Los Angeles recently. Or there was a protester, I believe. And he had some videotape, and he was locked up and imprisoned. And the reason he was locked up and imprisoned was, and he was taken to a federal court, federal district court. And they said that he had some footage of a burning police car. Well, why wouldn't he go into the state court? Why wouldn't he go into the criminal court? Well, guess what? He didn't go into a state or criminal court because the federal government said, we gave the LAPD, I believe it was Los Angeles Police Department, Los Angeles, California, we gave them some money. So technically that police car is ours. And you have the subverting of local law enforcement across the country. And then you're not going to, it's the best way to shut them up is to give them some money and hide them away. And that's what they've been doing in America.
Right. Well, essentially it's bribery on a grand scale then, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Legal, perfectly legal bribery.
All right. Well, in terms of... Are there laws being violated by this? Because the one thing I found that was very difficult in New Zealand is that when the government passes a law that violates a law, they say, well, we're the lawmakers, we can do that.
Interesting.
I mean, we're the lawmakers, we can make the law up, basically.
Okay, so you have no supreme law in New Zealand then?
We have a Supreme Prime Minister. Basically, he comes in, he appoints everybody into his own handpicked, unelected cabinet, and any law that he wants passed, which people don't want passed, he says it's urgent, and then they pass it urgently. So, you know, things like that. He locks everybody in Parliament overnight, and basically, unless they're willing to filibuster and not go to the bathroom, yeah, whatever tyrannical law or craziness or whatever is going to wind up being passed anyway. And I think they pass like 2 laws a day on average.
Wow.
Since taking power, plus.
Wow.
Well, nobody has any idea what the hell's in them. Nobody knows that these laws are even being passed, you know? I mean, we're living in the same frickin' police state, you and I, even though we're separated by 10,000 kilometers of frickin' water.
right, we are. And our police state, the difference is, well, I guess it actually has a similarity, because I don't think New Zealand doesn't pretend that it's a first world country, that it doesn't have a police state, that it's a free country. And the U.S. does the same type of pretending. We pretend we're a free country, but by even the Merriam-Webster definition, we're a police state. We're a regime that's repressive in the political, economic, and social areas, and using police to enforce the law, enforce the rule of government. So in essence, we're a police state here as well. And I think both of our countries attempt to say they're not. But when I'm not sure what it is in New Zealand, but over here, we have to be careful what we say. Free speech? Oh, yeah, there's a lot of free speech here, until you want to speak against the government. All of a sudden, your free speech rights go.
Like a drone anymore. That's run out of fuel.
Yeah, exactly. It's like they all they have to do is, I mean, Brandon Robb, look at him. He's a honorably served in the Marine Corps, and he posted some rap lyrics on his Facebook page, and they detained him at a psych ward for 4 or 5, actually it was almost 2 weeks, and only because of his Facebook post. And they got people who they're holding on trial because they liked some pages that were linked to Al-Qaeda. So yeah, what free speech? We don't have free speech in America anymore. It's free speech until you think about exercising your real free speech rights, which was to have the ability to speak against the current government and political system and ideology of the time. But as soon as you do that, you'll find out that there really isn't any free speech rights here.
Hmm. So somebody says death to America, and somebody clicks like, and then he goes to Guantanamo.
Could, or could get a nice intimidation visit from federal agents. There was a kid out in Cleveland, Ohio, who had produced a video, and it was, and he had talked to his teacher about the Illuminati. Now, whether you believe in them or not is irrelevant. The fact is, he had talked to them about his teacher about the Illuminati. His teacher reported him, and the FBI shows up at his house and questions him for a few hours. So, yeah, you have free speech until you use your free speech for the reason that it was put in the U.S. Bill of Rights. Until an American uses their free speech for the reason it was there, which is to be able to speak out against whatever current regime was running the country.
Whoa. So I can say I love American Idol, but I can't say I hate the American government.
That's yeah.
Freedom.
Yeah, pretty much.
Are you kidding me? We'll be right back after the break with Dan Johnson from PandaUnite.com, ladies and gentlemen.
There's something evolving. whatever may come, the world keeps revolving. They say the next big thing is here, that the revolution's near. But to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
Precisely what it is. Welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's our final segment here for the first hour. And my very special guest is Dan Johnson from PandaUnite.org, the people against the NDAA. You know, something tells me that there's got to be some kind of retrovirus available, you know, some DNA disrupting NDAA destroying kind of vaccination program that could be given to Congress people so that they become allergic to tyranny whenever they start to exhibit certain instances of communist fascistic scumbaggery. They suddenly go and have a cardiac arrest. That would be awesome.
Well,
I could dream. I
could power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. If such a thing were to be devised, the person who wielded the power to wake the Congress people up would wield great power, would eventually become corrupt, and we'd be right back where we started from for working with the quick fix instead of actually taking the time and realizing that it takes time and effort to restore a country from tyranny.
But can I correct you there? The quote is actually, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And
yes,
all great men are inherently evil.
Oh, really? That's the full quote?
That's the full Lord Acton quote. And most people miss out the third line because a lot of people think of themselves as great men who are incorruptible when it's anything but.
I'll have to look that up. That's excellent. That's a good third line. Talk about breaking down an ego.
Yeah. That's how I see myself as well. As a potentially corrupt scumbag, and I think maybe we all should think of ourselves in that way to an extent, and surround ourselves with people who expose corrupt behavior and things of that nature. So, if let's say you or I, Dan, ever turned into, heaven forbid, some form of douchebag, all our friends would expose us and remove us from power so that we couldn't continue to do damage to people, don't you think? Unfortunately,
right,
Congress and the Senate and the presidency and the cabinets and the Fortune 500 companies don't surround them with people who spot corruption. They spot them. They surround themselves with people who only enforce it and ensure that it's continued to the detriment of us all.
Well, we gave 535 people the keys to our liberty, and that was our legislative branch, the representatives of the people. We gave them the keys to our liberty. And there is no one to blame but we the people for where our country's at. We the people are the government. We cannot blame the government for something that we are. And it is up to us now, since we have started it, since we obviously had an effect on it, we obviously can have an effect to fix it. We made this problem. We can fix this problem. If we didn't make the problem, maybe we wouldn't be able to fix the problem. But we the people made this problem. Now we the people can fix this problem and must fix this problem.
Well, we need a massive shift in the public consciousness. I mean, as Einstein said, the same mentality that created the problem will not be the same mentality to fix it, or words to that effect. What is it about Americans that needs to change before this kind of liberty principle can be restored? What is different between the Americans who fought in the Revolutionary War and the Americans today who fight wars against imaginary digital enemies on computer screens and fly drones and blow up children with Hellfire missiles.
The difference is, back when the American Revolution started, the Founding Fathers had 3%. That's why there's several militias in the United States called 3%ers. The Founding Fathers had 3% of the people participate in the revolution. By all guesses and estimates and very, very low-balling it in America, we have 7% of the country aware that the government is stealing their rights and taking their liberty. We don't need to wake anyone else up. There's a simple rule in business, the 80-20 rule. 20% of the people will do 80% of the work. If you try to get 100% of the people to do 100% of the work, you will fail. You need to focus on the people who will actually do something. We have 7%, twice what the founders had. We have 7% in the United States of people who understand what's going on, but are not taking any action besides trying to wake, quote-unquote, wake up the other 93%. Well, guess what? Most of the other 93%, and little by little, they'll come around. But with the time scale and the time frame we have, most of that 93% will not wake up. We need to shift focus. What needs to happen in America, what needs to happen in the world, is people need to shift focus from, quote-unquote, waking people up, to taking the people who are awake and galvanizing them to action. Making sure the people who are awake have an action to perform. We have the numbers. We don't have the action with those numbers. We have the people who we need. The rest of the public will follow along. 3% American Revolution. Yet, after the Constitutional Convention, after the Bill of Rights was ratified, most of the country was on board with the idea.
You know, this reminds me of Occupy Wall Street protesters, and they saw themselves as the 99%, whereas I saw them as the 1%, because they were the 1% of people who actually tended to give a frack and want to go out and do something about it. The problem is you need at least
3%. Yeah, and obviously, without going into the history of social movements in the United States, Occupy had the disadvantage that there was really no older generation to give Occupy direction. And Occupy viewed itself as decentralized. Go ahead.
In New Zealand, that was very, very different. We had a number of older activists, but you know what happened? The older activists got ignored by the younger activists who thought that they knew better and didn't learn from their experience.
And that is why Occupy rose up like a flame and died just as quick.
Like a candle in the wind.
Like a candle in the wind. Tea Party was not much better because the divide and conquer has worked very well. I'm sure it's worked very well in New Zealand. It's worked very well in the United States. It's gender against gender, age against age, religion against religion, race against race. And the big thing with the Tea Party here is that movement exists here and there, and there's still at least a little bit of a fire with it, but it died almost as quickly as Occupy because the older people in the movement won't have the passion. They don't have the passion. You have to have a younger generation to invigorate a movement, and the movement fell apart.
Well, see, and there's two elements. There's two elements I'd like to say here is that I consider my mentors in this movement and the people who gave me my show, the people who mentored me into it and all of that kind of stuff, to be the ones who gave me the skills from their experience that was necessary in order to put my energy to good use as a young person. The elders have the experience, they've got the know-how, but they don't have the energy in many cases to implement these things that they were once capable of doing. And the youth, on the other hand, have the energy, but they have none of the experience. And I believe that it's not one generation or the other that will wind up leading us into freedom. It will, in fact, be those generations working together
Precisely.
To compensate for what both of us lack.
Yeah, and then the American people have to realize, cast off the dividing lines, realize these aren't gay rights, these aren't women's rights, these aren't civil rights, these are human rights. These are inalienable human rights. And cast off the boundaries that keep us from each other, that keep us from working together. And realize that this is a war for our rights. And I want to take a quick few notes from one of my very favorite people. And his name is Patrick Henry. And I'm sure you're familiar.
Heard of him. I don't think I've heard him on the show.
And although this was a call to violent action in the revolution, it was also a call to arms. And in America, yeah, we need a call to arms. We need a call to a peaceful revolution in America. But we need a revolution. There is no longer any room for hope. If we wish to be free, if we mean to preserve and violate those intestinable privileges for which we have been so long contending, if we mean not basely to abandon the noble struggle in which we have so long engaged, and which we have pledged ourselves never to abandon until the glorious object of our contest shall be obtained. We must fight. I repeat it, sir. We must fight. It is vain, sir, to extenuate the matter. Gentlemen may cry peace, peace, but there is no peace. The war has actually begun. The next gale that sweeps from the north will bring to our ears the clash of resounding arms. Our brethren who are already in the field, why stand we here idle? What is it that gentlemen wish?
Oh, hold on. That's it. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guest is Andrew McGregor. Andrew, we seem to be having a little bit of a problem with your camera. That button for your camera there that I got you to click before, if you click it again, it'll just turn it off. There was a little bit of a difficulty getting your voice. That's good. That's good right there. Okay, cool. All right, Andrew, welcome to the program. We're going to be talking about the Port Arthur Massacre. It's like the ultimate shooting debacle in Australian history, which much like almost every shooting debacle that happens in every other country, New Zealand's had them, America's had them, they just get used to demonize all gun owners and were probably most likely false flag attacks in and of themselves to begin with that were orchestrated in order to get people's guns. So welcome to the program, and I really want to learn a bit more about this because I'm not terribly well informed, I must say.
It would be nice if you had been a little bit informed. You could have asked some rather relevant questions or questions that would have been relevant to you. Port Arthur Massacre, for a start, Vinny, can you tell me which is the world capital for Lonut mass killings?
It's a good question. I don't know.
How about Melbourne in Victoria, really? Australia? We've had four of them.
How interesting. How come it's not hyped up on the news and repeated over and over and over again?
I don't think the anti-gunners or the government will be greatly amused with that type of, thing going on in Australia, but that is the actual fact that we had the first Lonut gun massacre shooting on the 9th of August 1987 with Julian Knight at the Hoddle Street which is Clifton Hill, the suburb of Melbourne. And Julian Knight survived. He was caught by two members of the Fitzroy Uniform Police. And he stated that he didn't know what he was doing. He thought he was shooting Martians, which simply means it is under a major psychosis. The next shooting took place in about December 1987 in the Queen Street Massacre, which is the Queen Street, the philatelic post office. Now, that particular building was a federal building with federal security in it. And the gunman, who apparently had never been there before, managed to get past the security. And he was going around ranting. And one of the rants he made that people heard and remembered was, "How do they expect me to kill people with this gun?" Which was an M1 carbine, and they fit it in the bag he used to carry it to the this area. Somebody had cut off part of the butt and then the part of the barrel, which immediately stopped the M1 from being a semi-automatic, and it could only be hand-loaded, or, you know, with the action, and this particular firearm jammed more times than it actually fired. So that was the second one. Then we had the Abortion Street killings in East Melbourne in 2001, and then finally in 2003 we had the Monash University shooting. In both those last two incidents, some of the supposed sacrificial lambs actually jumped up and grabbed the gunman and stopped it. The real interesting thing with the Monash University shooting was when Associate Professor Brett Inder entered the room, the gunman said to him, "It was all I could do."
Now, Andrew, before you continue, by the way that you're recounting these instances and the details that you're recounting and the way that you do, it would lead me to suspect that you have actually had a career where such a skill is necessary. Were you a police officer or something?
I was a member of the Victoria Police Force from 68 till 85. I retired in health in 1985 after running into some problems with a thing called corruption.
That'll do it.
Every time.
Every time. So can I ask you about yourself personally before we actually continue on to talk about mass shootings and the Port Arthur massacre, some of your experiences and kind of who you are as a person so the audience can become familiar as well as myself?
Well, I joined the Victoria Police Force in 1968, the year after my eldest sister was murdered by a former boyfriend on the front yard of my parents' house in West Heidelberg. And, that had upset me greatly. He was later found in a creek area a couple of miles away from home. He'd committed suicide. But that took place on a 24th birthday, and I was extremely upset that it had happened, and that previous actions by the police had failed to take the gun off at this deranged person, and he was able to kill my sister. So I'm not a person particularly fond of firearms, but I'm not a person against firearms. Firearms are a tool, an implement. They never jump up and shoot people. It's somebody's got to pull the trigger. And so when the Port Arthur massacre finally came around, and I can remember listening to the radio on the car when it was first announced, about a gunman going mad, and I turned the radio off in disgust because I knew it was going to be psyched up. Later on, I came around to study it. I got a copy of the court transcript where Martin Bryant was sentenced. Martin Bryant was never put on trial, and he should have been. Prior, the day of his arrest, one of the members of the Coalition for Gun Control stated quite emphatically that Martin Bryant had a mental condition, which simply meant that he was suffering from schizophrenia. And if you're suffering from schizophrenia, there had to be a trial. So another anti-gunner came along, Professor Paul Mullen, who said, no, he didn't. He only had a personality disorder. He was competent to be tried. But there was never a trial. Martin Bryant, on the 30th September, when he was facing his first hearing, pleaded not guilty to all charges. And his solicitor, Lieutenant Colonel David Gunson, the head of the legal bar in Hobart, immediately stood aside, and the solicitor, John Avery, took over. Now, John Avery also represented Carlene Bryant, Martin Bryant's mother, and the gun dealer, Terry Hill. Now, it's extremely interesting with the gun dealer because shortly before Avery took over for Bryant, Avery had written to Terry Hill asking him to give evidence that he had sold the murder weapons to Martin Bryant, which was a lie. And Terry Hill declined to tell this particular lie, and so the police ended up raiding his shop and closed his business down, collected all his books. These are just little aspects of what's happened. You start reading the sentencing document, and you're absolutely amazed. You then start reading the witness statements, and they are absolutely astounding. The first thing you find out is that when, according to the police documents, when David and Sally Martin were killed at between 10:30 and 12 o'clock, that Martin Bryant was 58 kilometres away drinking coffee, as per the witness statement. You've got witnesses stating that Martin Bryant arrived at the Seascape Cottage, which was the first and the final scenes, at 12:30. The shootings were heard by other witnesses from Seascape Cottage from 10:40 a.m. And that's from four different witnesses. So you've got major problems with the police evidence, and you can understand why the whole Tasmanian government, the Australian federal government, all required Martin Bryant to plead guilty, which John Avery was finally able to coerce Martin Bryant to do so simply by getting Martin Bryant's mother to go in and tell Martin if he didn't plead guilty, then neither she nor Martin's sister would ever be able to visit him at Brisbane Prison. That's really not a legalist assisting a client.
It sounds like somebody didn't want him to talk. Or have contact with anybody that might try and, I don't know, spread out
nobody's permitted to speak to Martin Bryant. That was made perfectly clear in an article by Gary Linnell in the Bulletin in about 1998.
Oh, come on. Even Charles Manson was allowed to have people talk to him, and he was a knowing mass murderer.
No, well, Martin Bryant, his mother got one visit to him, and she asked him if he'd actually did these things at Port Arthur, and he said it must have been a police setup. And after that, he became too agitated, and she was frightened to ask him anything further.
Define police setup. What evidence do we have that there was police present? Was there any reports of multiple shooters, things of that nature?
There were reports of multiple shooters. I've named the main shooter at Seascape Cottage to be Sergeant Michael Charles Dyson of the Tasmania Police Special Operations Group. The shooter at the Port Arthur historic site as being Benjamin Overbeek. And I've stated that quite emphatically, and nobody sued me as yet.
What are those gentlemen's background? Do they have military training or just police training?
The shooter at the Port Arthur historic site was a 20-year-old. I don't know what actual training he had. There's no record of him being in the Australian Army. But the person inside who did the shooting at the Port Arthur had been very properly trained. You could people saw him moving around and pirouetting when he was shooting inside the cafe. He certainly knew how to handle firearms. But the real interesting thing about the Port Arthur massacre is the number of ASIO, that's the Australian Security and Intelligence Organisation, they lost 7 people that day. Our equivalent to the CIA lost 7 operatives at the Port Arthur massacre. And there are over 30 of them that that can be identified.
How could we account for that? I mean, were they armed, capable of defending themselves? Were they?
They were all there as witnesses. There was there were 4 American spooks there: William and Marianne Bittner, and James Belasco, and his fiancée Cynthia. And Cynthia's got a horrible Polish name that I can't pronounce.
So maybe it was in some part an international training operation of how to stage shootings, perhaps?
The gunman told 2 witnesses. That's Gay Lind and her friend Vicky, who were in a van broke the radiator, or the motor had overheated, and they had to put more water in the radiator. And they're waiting for the motor to cool down. The gunman stopped behind them to find out what they were doing there. He bought some marijuana from them, and he then told them that he was going to the Isle of the Dead, which was the Port Arthur Historic Site Cemetery, to kill some wasps. We have another spook, Rob Atkins, who was quoted on the all news media, both Channel 2 and Channel 9, that the gunman was saying, going around saying that there was not many Japs here, there's a lot of wasps. And in fact, there are 2 busloads of, what you'd call coachloads of American tourists on the site that day who arrived unexpectedly. And the ferry that would take them to the Isle of the Dead and do a run around the Isle of the Dead and the other area around that, the Bundina, had a fortnight previously changed from a summer timetable to a winter timetable. And all the doctor's seminar at the Royal Hobart Hospital on that seminar closed at 1:30. The shooting at the Port Arthur Historic Site had to take place at 1:30. But it was supposed to take place on the ferry. It didn't, because the timetable had changed. So the gunman then took out the patrons in the Broad Arrow Cafe, which was supposed to be a secure site. And the first Australian spook to get shot was Anthony Nightingale, who jumped up and shouted, "No, no, not here." And the medic got shot in the throat. People will argue that how do you know that Anthony Nightingale was a spook? Well, his job was listed here as a loans officer for the Commonwealth Bank stationed at Noble Park. That doesn't prove anything. But then you get another Commonwealth employee who was at the site at the time. And these all people are supposedly on holidays. Lynn Beavers, she later on in about 2002 sued her employees, the Commonwealth Bank, and Audiometrics of 814 Hawthorne Road, Burke Road, Hawthorne, sued them for injuries she sustained when she had to go inside the Broad Arrow Cafe to identify other Commonwealth Bank employees. And the only Commonwealth Bank employee that was inside the Broad Arrow Cafe and was dead was Anthony Nightingale. So that immediately tells you that, A, they were working at the time, and, B, they had to be spooks.
Well, let's leave it there for the moment and come back after the break. Former Victorian police officer Andrew Sutherland McGregor is my guest, talking about the Port Arthur massacre. We'll be right back, folks.
And gentlemen, do me a favor, smash the television and burn the newspaper. That shit will never tell you that the president's a traitor. Believe what you want, but my evidence is greater. What you know about
welcome
the
back.
Bilderberg and New World Order? What you know about the real floor?
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the show that's all about the New World Order. And my very special guest is Andrew Sutherland McGregor, former Victorian police officer, now retired, and he is an expert of note on the Port Arthur massacres. And as everybody knows, whenever a massacre happens, in come the leftist, communist, globalist, scumbaggery individuals. Regardless of what party, whether that be the Labour Party in New Zealand or Australia or the Democratic Party in the United States, they are all UN-loving, globalist, gun-grabbing, communist, freedom-hating scum at the end of the day. They may deny it, but their policy says different. Now, interestingly enough, during the 1994 gun ban that the Clintons passed in the United States, you had some kind of a information relevant to that regarding the Port Arthur massacre there, Andrew.
Well, the Labor Party in Australia brought out the same list. It was brought out by Rebecca Peters, an American who came out here in 1984, studied at Sydney University, I think it was, studied law, gave it up, worked for the ABC, which is the Australian Broadcasting Commission, a very leftist body. And then she headed the Coalition for Gun Control in Australia. And after 96, she went back to America claiming to be an Australian. So if you ever hear of Dr. Rebecca Peters claiming she's an Australian, she's not. She was born in America. She came out here, got nationalised and has gone back to America, continually pushing the George Soros agendas. And George Soros is the one who's been paying for all of her things. I think George Soros was also one of the major contributors to Obama's election campaign as well.
Okay. Now, you also told me over the break that Clinton was in Canberra around the addressing the Australian Parliament around the time of the Port Arthur massacre shootings, or did I hear that incorrectly?
No. When Martin Bryant was being sentenced, the sentencing hearing took place on the 19th, 20th and 22nd of November 1996. On the 21st of November 1996, President Bill Clinton was in Canberra, Australia, addressing both houses of the federal parliament. As one of my friends noted, when President Clinton first arrived in Australia and greeted Johnny Howard, he said, "Well done with your gun laws, mate." So, okay. You know, the agenda with the gun laws, when you're looking at the Second Amendment in America, don't look just at America. Have a look globally. Have a look at Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and the United Kingdom, because they're all involved in the same thing to remove handguns from the general population. The agenda is not just for American. So when you get the Sandy Hook massacre and Bill Clinton's, you have a look at that, and you then associate with the Dunblane massacre, which virtually went down with the exact same modus operandi.
Okay. Well, they don't seem to come up with any new game plans ever. It's always the same one over and over and over again. And strangely enough, everybody still keeps falling for these exact same parlor tricks. Have you noticed that?
Look, three very nice anti-gunners, it's Christopher Cantor from the Brisbane University, Professor Paul Mullen from the Monash University, and Philip Alphers Alpers, who is at the moment assisting. Who's your vice president? Who's the American? What's it? Liebman, what's his name is?
Joe Biden.
Well,
yeah.
Philip Alpers at the moment is advising Joe Biden on the success of the so-called gun laws in Australia. He's talking rubbish, but they put out a lovely article called Mass Homicides, the Civil Homicides, was in a paper for the Psychiatry and the Law, printed only in America in about 2000, where they go through and list all the, there's I think, seven different massacres at the time, and they state quite emphatically that the original massacre was created by Charles Joseph Whitman at the University of Texas, shooting in, was it August 1966? They said 1963, but that was the first lone-nut gun massacre, according to them. Then you have a look at the second lone-nut gun massacre, which was the McDonald's, the Huberty McDonald's massacre in 1984, and that was the first one that was used to bring in regulations for gun laws, and that followed the Brady coalition for I call them the Brady Bunch. It's quite easy. What was it? The Brady Coalition for Handgun Control, or something like that, which was created after Brady was wounded in the attempted assassination of President Reagan in 1981. So you have a look at that, and yes, every massacre, as far as they're concerned, follows the same modus operandi as the University of Texas massacre from 1966. And when you have a look at them, they do.
Okay. Continue, please. Because this is a big, complicated topic, and I feel in an inadequate position to actually inquire into things without knowing more specific information, which I'm sure that you do actually possess. So I actually kind of want you to take the reins and continue to elaborate on this as much as you can, because I'm actually quite absorbed in listening to you at the moment.
All right.
I apologize for putting you on the spotlight that as well.
After there was the Virginia Tech massacre, and I forget the name of the Korean student who supposedly went off his head and did all the shootings, I did an article, a 22-page article on that, and it went right through the various not only the Lone Nut Gun massacres, but also some of the required American assassinations. And I used the article, as I said, Mass Homicide, the Civil Massacres by Cantor, Mullen and Alpers. And I also used another article, it was about the shooting of John Lennon, called The FBI Was the Shooter in the Rye. And you put those two articles together, and you've got a quite clear picture of the gun agenda, as you know, or the anti-firearm agenda in America from 1994 with the Clinton administration. But it's not that difficult to follow once you see. If you put a person under a psychosis, one way or another, and you've got total control of him, he will do what he requires. Now, in Australia, in the 1987 massacres, with Julian Knight stating that, you know, he believed he was shooting invading Martians, that tells you that the person is definitely not sane and he's under a psychosis. When you have the second shooter at the Queen Street massacre, which was Frank Vilovic, again, when you're yelling out, how do they expect me to kill people with this gun, and some of the other statements, you also realise that he is not sane. He is under a psychosis. Now, Julian Knight and Julian Knight and Martin Bryant were the only two in Australia to actually survive the massacres, the mass shootings. But the also James Knight, who did the abortion clinic shooting in 2002 in East Melbourne, he survived, and it took the Victoria Police 3 months to actually identify him. Nobody knew who he was. Now, in our modern society, how can you get a person, you know, that remains unidentified for 3 months? No fingerprints, nothing on him. And again, if you have a look at the going into shooting an abortion clinic, there's about the same time I think there was a shooting, an abortion shooting in America. Somebody shot a doctor, a couple of his patients as well. And all these things is the United Nations agenda. You know, people are permitted to have abortions if they want to. Well, that's their decision. If it's not against the law, but all you get the whole time is you are not permitted to attack this and that. It's a whole United Nations thinking control. It's a part of their agendas. So you have a look at in 2005-2006, the Clinton push on the ban of certain guns, the thing was coming to a close. President Bush was going to sign on it, but he never did. So you've got the gun control agenda up, and then you get the shootings at University at Montreal, one of the colleges at Montreal. There was another one, and then there's the Mines massacre where the Amish girls were massacred. Every time there is a gun agenda, there's massacres. There's low nut gun massacres. Now, that tells you it has to be a political agenda, nothing else, because people don't erupt spontaneously and go out and do things on a political line. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah.
Right. So when Hillary Clinton and the State Department are signing up the United Nations agenda on opposite the arms trade ban, whatever it was, AWT, I think it was in July. That's where you get the Aurora shootings. You've got the political agenda. And again, when Chief Dan Oates was being interviewed and somebody asked him about the door being opened at the theatre, he takes a great big swallow. Dan Oates from Colorado doesn't like telling lies, but he's forced to at this time because immediately behind him is FBI agent James F. Yacone. Well, I think that's how you pronounce his name. And you immediately see, you know, there's something wrong. You also have a look at the Aurora shooting. You've got a couple of witnesses stating, that they saw somebody opening the door for the gunman after the person answered a mobile phone. He then went popped the fire exit door open, and they thought this is strange. It was even stranger when a bloke comes in and starts killing everybody with a AR-15 and a 100-round mag. But the day after that, you then get the professional witness, Christopher Ramos, came in on one of the things and was stating sort of thing, there was only the one shooter. Now, anyone who listened to Christopher Ramos sort of thing and knew what they were talking about, we were in the presence. Christopher Ramos is a professional witness. We've had them at the Port Arthur massacre. We've had them at the London bombing. We've had them at 9/11. These are people who immediately come out and give the right agenda. Or, when something goes wrong, they need to negate proper evidence. They'll come out and give the required evidence. And when you have a look at the Sandy Hook massacre, again, you've got these professional witnesses, people who will come out and give the required line, and you listen to it later on, you say, you know, that's not correct with what I've already heard. You get professional witnesses, and they're rather easy to identify once you know what you're looking for.
Well, specifically, what are you looking for when you're looking for these witnesses?
Well, the first thing is that they know too much, and they apparently see too much. Now, if you're at a shooting, the first thing you do is you put your head down so the thing you start looking for an escape route. So with Christopher Ramos, where he sees the gunman spraying this, he sees the bloke next to him being shot, he's seeing too much. Christopher Ramos, and when most people speak and they need to stop or they get their thoughts back in order, they use the R pause. I've got to tell you this, but Christopher Ramos, when he was doing his speaking, used the words just and like to fill in for the R, so he never stopped talking. He's been trained to speak without pausing, without giving the media head a chance to interrupt his line of presentation.
A professional.
Say again?
With professionalism, in other words, trained to speak to the media. I've seen many, many, many people speak to the media, and as you say, the ums, the ahs, they become very apparent, particularly in sports people. But those who don't, on the other hand, who answer everything with crystal clear clarity and don't stop talking, they're usually the well-trained politicians and talking heads. We'll be right back with Andrew McGregor. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Final segment we have with Andrew McGregor, former Victorian police, retired, and he's talking about massacres, gun shooting massacres, and trained professional people coming on. Now, you were talking about some form of witness who came up while he was allegedly on holiday wearing a suit. Now, I don't know about you, ladies and gentlemen, but when I'm on holiday, I barely wear any clothes at all, let alone a fracking suit.
The other thing that was very interesting was his wife was about 7 months pregnant. Now, how many people would actually travel on an aircraft when they're 7 months pregnant? Do aircraft permit people in such a condition to fly?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I thought you're not allowed to.
No, if she starts giving birth on the plane, sort of thing, it's a major problem for the air crew and for the safety of the child. She's not supposed to. But Robin Atkins, with her husband, 7 months pregnant, he's on the tie. He's talking about the police present at Port Arthur, and there was none. He's talking about how good everything was, and it was rubbish, and he knew too much. And so once you put it all together and read it properly, there's only one conclusion you can come to, and he is a professional witness. He was down there on the spot. Another witness that was at the Port Arthur historic site was John Radler. Now, John Radler was the head guy of CNN in Australia, and he was down there at Hobart at the time. And he was preparing to give the news briefing of what happened at Port Arthur, and CNN had given him 3 days for the Port Arthur massacre. Now, what's so important about Australia to CNN that they'll give them 3 days interviewing, time on the CNN radio? Please tell me, or CNN News, why would CNN have 3 days available for John Radler in regard to the Port Arthur massacre? How about if you lost 70 American tourists killed down there?
Mm.
Then Bill Clinton and Hillary would have been bringing in their 1994 hit list sort of thing and attacking the Second Amendment by the State Department, because that'd force Australia to bring in gun laws, and then those gun laws would be reciprocated in America. And that took place in 1996, and that was what the Port Arthur massacre was all about.
Okay. What resulting legislation was there that was implemented? Like, as a gun owner in Australia, what difference does it make? Did it make to their daily lives before versus after the incident, after the shooting?
Well, there was apparently about 6 to 8 million firearms in Australia before the new gun laws were brought in. There was about 680,000 of them were handed in the gun buyback. And it was all done under the Health Act. You understand? It was paid through Medicare. What's Obama doing? Exactly the same modus operandi again as the Australians. I think there are over 1 million AK-47s vanished in Australia. They're all buried in somebody's backyards and things like that. They've been shipped in Australia prior to the laws and these new gun laws coming in, and the owners, for some unknown reason, especially... See, Victoria had gun registrations. They were brought in by John Cain in 1984-85. And once you get, you know, and in Victoria, once the new gun laws came in, all Victorian gun owners believed that if they didn't hand it in, the police would be knocking on their door. And so they had no choice. Other states that didn't have registration, a lot of firearms got buried. What else can I say? The new gun laws they brought in, magazines, I think it's a minimum of three. Look, I'm not a shooter. I'm not a firearm owner. I know a couple of people who do. And as I said, you know, a firearm is only an implement. It's a tool. If you go out shooting foxes, sort of thing, sometimes you want a little bit more than three rounds up a clip. And if you're up north and you're hunting some of these wild pigs, you don't want only two shots, just in, you know. Yes,
From my perspective, rifles and things of that nature, it matters not how many bullets are in the clip. I mean, it's just simply like, I mean, if I have a DVD printer, for example, that only prints one DVD, but I want one that has the ability to print 10, what is the government going to do? Saying, you don't need the ability to print 10 DVDs, we'll pass a law against it. No, it's just an implement. If I'm using it for crime, sure, investigate me, prosecute me, but don't restrict my access to technology that currently exists that would actually make legal and lawful activities easier. And regardless, the reason why they tell everybody you can't have these certain amount of bullets and clips, like in New Zealand, it's, I think, 10 maximum in a clip. And the reason why the Americans have the Second Amendment isn't in any way, shape or form to do with hunting. There's nothing in the Constitution about you need to have a certain amount of bullets or whatever to hunt ducks or things like that. It's simply that you need the population to be – sorry, you just need to be as well-armed in the population in terms of militia as the government or police would be, because you look at any other country through history where the police and the military are armed and the population is disarmed, it's called a police state.
No. You put it wrong. Second Amendment states quite emphatically that every American will be the militia. There was, at the time, they weren't considering of having an army or a police force. It was the militia. And the militia represented the people. The people had the rights to defend themselves against tyrannical government. What do you have in America today? A tyrannical government. How do you know it's tyrannical? Simply because it's schizophrenic. A schizophrenic person is one who believes that everybody is out there to get me. Everybody, right? The American government believes that all Americans are potential terrorists. How dare they have it? It's pure schizophrenic.
Criminal psychosis, I think, is a disease not only of the mind, but a disease of institutions. And unfortunately, that's what we've got in the government these days, in almost all of our governments, I'd say.
Well, when you know, you have a look, I think it was a police officer by the name of Jack Lamb was speaking about 15, 16 years ago, talking about what the FBI was doing and how the federal government was taking over all the little law enforcement agencies throughout Australia, the sheriffs, the state police, the county police, whatever. And they were training them, and I'll use the word here, indoctrination, because it is pure indoctrination, and they're frightened at the people. Now, in the Victoria police, we used to have people that used to talk about them versus us, the police, you know. And you then start asking the question, how can a policeman protect and look after the community if it's them versus me? He can't do it. He needs to go on sick leave sort of thing and possibly find a new job. I look at a lot of people in government today, they need to find new jobs. But, all right, let's get on the one thing about the Port Arthur massacre. Martin Bryant was never trained. The gunman was. Martin Bryant, when the first two people were supposedly murdered, that's David and Sally Martin, was 58 kilometres away drinking coffee. Martin Bryant had never been properly trained in the use of firearms. The person at the Port Arthur Historic Site was. And when I started giving my lectures in 2001 and stating how the gunman deliberately targeted and shot Mrs. Nanette Mikak and her two young daughters, people jumped at me. How dare I be so nasty? But the actual fact is that the part of the agendas for the gun thing is to murder women and children at schools. And that was a Purdy in 1989 was one of the ones who first started over in America. So you have a look at the whole agenda. These lownut gun massacres by our governments, but that's America and Australia, have been quite prepared to murder innocent women and children. They're not even going after the men. They don't want the men. They're going after the highest form of trauma possible. It's take out the women and children. You also get different disinformation agents coming along and blaming it on Israel or Mossad or things like that. That's totally irrelevant. The people who are attacking you are your own government, be it Australian or be it American. It's not a foreign government that's attacking you. It's the own government. Joe Viles wrote down sort of thing and said that the Port Arthur massacre was a Mossad-run operation. The Mossad never controlled the federal organisation called the Protective Security Coordination Centre, which ran the massacre. So no matter what you believe, number one thing, if there's a gun massacre in a country, and that includes Norway, then that particular government has to run the massacre.
I think that's actually a nice cheery note to leave it on. Thank you, Andrew. McGregor.
You've had enough of me, Vince.
This is, actually, we've run out of time, unfortunately.
Right,
yeah. So can anybody search you up on YouTube or on Google, Andrew McGregor, Port Arthur Massacre, to learn more, ladies and gentlemen. See you again sometime.